Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
So my co-founders and I are serial entrepreneurs. We like to build B2B technology companies. We're a little bit nerdy for business problems to solve, and we tend to kind of go for the biggest challenge out there. So prior to Sitoply, we founded and exited three other companies.
Wow, that's exciting. And three, you know, it's definitely a volume to speak for. Especially just being an entrepreneur myself, and now being on the other side of the equation, on the dark side as an investor, I know firsthand how hard that is to, you know, build one company, let alone three. So that's, I can't wait to unpack a lot of that with you. Maybe briefly tell us about the previous companies that you have built. Were they similar in nature, and what were some of the problems that you guys were solving through the solutions that you were creating?
So the one prior was called Everything Benefits, and it was a complete benefits management solution. So we had enrollment, COBRA, ACA, billing and payments, and a few other commercial products. And insurance industry is something, one of the oldest industries that is out there. Long way to go as far as making that technologically capable and getting it up to speed of the kind of products and tools that we enjoy today. And as it is something that affects every single one of us, when we looked at what other business problem to solve, we kind of thought about it and said, hey, look at this. This affects us. This affects our children. We got to try to go figure it out. And that's what prompted Everything Benefits to be born.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to, you know, just having one exit and selling one company, for a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of people, that's probably enough. And they go out and do other things, other fun stuff or whatever. You know, a lot of them become investors as well. So different paths. But for you, it seems like it's not much has changed. And then you just kept on the same path, which is, you know, company building. Tell us a little bit more maybe about that process, or maybe there's something from your early days that really kind of shaped and developed that entrepreneurial DNA in you.
Oh, I guess I'll take you a little bit, quite a bit far. When in college, I started to study computer science. I really enjoyed the atmosphere of camaraderie. If you get to see other people's code, you can understand how they think, how do they approach to solving problems. We would go to class during the day, and at night would hang out in the computer lab and play games. And that amazing spirit of kind of working together, collaborating, having fun together, one of the most amazing experiences from college. So when I started my career on Wall Street at some of the largest investment firms out there, kind of missed that spirit, you know, being together, solving problems together with some of the very, very large companies. The ability, at least that early in my career, to impact was very, very small. And so I really missed that spirit of building things together, being together, solving problems. And so that's what's prompted me. And I was fortunate to get together with a bunch of really awesome co-founders to start building our first venture. And got to experience that again. And gradually, in the course of kind of working through these different ventures, my focus has changed from building software to actually engaging with people, getting out there, understanding their needs, their problems, and getting back together with the team to try to solve them together technologically. So that's kind of what drove that journey. And I kind of love living like back in the college days, hanging out there, so, you know, solving things, having fun together. And if you figure out what you really love to do in life, kind of want to keep doing it as long as you can. And that's what's prompting me and my partners to go at it again and again.
You've mentioned several times you and your partners, which speaks a lot about you as a leader and that mentality in general. And it also seems like the relationship aspect is very important to you, because it sounds like you built all these companies together more or less with the same people. Maybe tell us a little bit more about that. How did you essentially go about finding a co-founder and really understanding that you guys have that, you know, the dynamics in your relationship to be able to not only have fun and work great together, but also when it comes to very difficult situations and where, you know, when at the end of the day, when, you know, when there are problems, completely different ballgame. And how did you guys go about that? How did you guys build that relationship? Tell, you know, share some more insight into that process and what were some of the lessons learned through that?
So I was very fortunate to kind of find my long-term co-founders very early in the journey. And over time, I had seen some of the other startups kind of struggle with maybe having a single co-founder, a single founder that is working on the venture. Part of the challenge is it is a roller coaster ride and it is a marathon. You got to be prepared for the long haul, and having someone to share the highs and lows of the journey with, it cannot be understated. It's huge, and so lonely entrepreneurs, I think, are having a lot harder time really navigating the ebb and flow of the business. And then also when you are with a group of people that are building together with you, there's a tremendous amount of trust that you have into what they bring to the picture, that they have in you, that drives accountability. So it's a high level of accountability. If it's just you, you're accountable to yourself. But if it's you and your partners, you're accountable to them. Ultimately, you're accountable to your employees that trusted you to get on that journey with you. You're accountable to your clients. And so building the team, building the group around you helps to kind of support you forward, but also keeps you on your toes to make sure you're doing your best job every day.
Yeah, no, that probably goes a long way with any relationship from all aspects of life. So that makes a lot of sense what you're talking about. Taking things a little bit further to where you at now, and everything you're building with your current company. Maybe first tell us a little bit about it, and what were some of the motivating factors that really, you know, enabled you guys to come back together and say this is the problem that we want to solve.
So we're always in the building mode, more or less. I'm gonna kill all the joy burst a huge bubble here. Brilliant ideas just come into your head and you start. We actually have a laundry list of business problems that we every now and then we run into something in our day-to-day lives and professional lives and say, oh, wouldn't it be awesome for somebody to solve this problem? Our life would be so much easier. And we put that in that little file of brilliant ideas. And then every time we get on a new journey, we go through a systematic analysis to see, hey, has anyone solved it? Is it still interesting to be solved? Is it still relevant? Is it going to be enough of the impact, like benefits, like HR and payroll, to solve this particular challenge? And then as we go through that list, we ultimately stop at something that gets the whole group excited, and we get on the next journey. With Setuply, you know what, it was a little different. Nothing excited us from that list. There was a tremendous amount of progress in all spheres of business. And so when we kind of thought back and said, okay, so what was it about last business that made it, you know, more challenging than usual, specifically operating in a highly controlled, highly regulated space like insurance? And it was client onboarding. It's making sure we can get their important, critical, sensitive historical information. It's working with them through their change management journey. It's configuring their data on our software. And it's ultimately communicating with hundreds of insurance providers operating in North America. So that required us to really be on our toes and figure out how can we leverage technology? How can we take it to the edge to reduce the friction for everybody involved, our team, our clients, insurance carriers. And so when we thought about kind of some of our thought processes there, that translated into a lot of kind of vision into how would that work for other spaces? How would that work for fintech? How would that work for regtech? Have they solved that problem? And when we did our analysis and realized that 90% of them are of these awesome, huge solution providers, technology companies, and implementation organizations are using spreadsheets still, sort of a shoemaker's dilemma. And that mm-hmm. provided a lot of inspiration for, yeah, that's the journey we want to embark on.
Very interesting. And, you know, you would be very, you know, getting a glimpse into that ideas folder and essentially to take a look at what are the different ideas that you guys have on the table. That, you know, that's the secret sauce. But in all seriousness, that's very interesting, which leads me to further questions that I have when it comes to really understanding whether it's a legitimate problem and not just, you know, in your own little bubble. How did you guys go about validating that initially before actually setting out and saying, let's build the first iteration of that and come up with some type of a GTM strategy? Take us to the early days and what strategies really allowed you to validate that this was an actual problem and that that really motivated you to get the team together to build that?
Well, we started sort of a parallel process of figuring out how other businesses are solving this. So lots and lots of phone calls, getting on the phone, lots of emails, trying to understand, hey guys, what is that process like? How long does it take you? What tools do you use today? What are your biggest frustrations? And then going through that exercise, probably at this point, approaching 300 times, 300 different entities, I think you could get a pretty good read, maybe in 50 plus. But I think at this point, we sort of got this mad curiosity to say, okay, that 90% mark, the fact that 90% of the businesses, it continues to hold. We thought maybe we'll hit the market sector that has that problem solved, but not yet. So it's getting on the phone, it's listening to people's needs, it's asking questions, it's sometimes going back to the first conversations with the new information that you had gained. And trying to ask them differently to see if you can get something more. And ultimately, that validated that it is unmet need. And then we also looked at who is currently looking to solve that need. And I think we are at an interesting point of accelerating expansion of the client onboarding market. You have several factors at play. You have accelerating digital adoption. So lots of still aging technologies in enterprise players' hands. Lots of large enterprise companies looking to optimize their technology stack. So they're constantly in the buying upgrading mode. So technology providers are actually dealing with too many clients problem. They have a lot more clients coming through the door than necessarily they can accommodate. So there's a high inflow. On the other hand, your implementation staff is probably the one that gets burned out the fastest. The knowledge workers that work with the new customers, collect their information, work with them through the change management process. These guys, these ladies and men are extremely hard to find. It's a difficult job. And the minute you implement someone, you get another project given to you. So there's a high degree of burnout. So you have more customers, less implementation staff available, and unsuitable tools to get the job done with. The kind of combination of these three things is a good indication that it's probably time to solve the problem.
At the fund level, at least for us at Big Sky Capital, we at the core of the investment thesis is enterprise SaaS for various reasons, because, you know, our past experience working at enterprise and understanding the semantics of the sales funnel and what it takes to sell to enterprise B2B is completely different ballgame if you're selling something, you know, D2C or retail product. And then from a standpoint of the strategies that really helped you to get access to some of the decision makers and get some type of a feedback and validation, as you know, especially early days, a lot of startups, a lot of companies struggle from that standpoint, because navigating the complexities of, you know, a especially a large organization could be of a significant challenge, especially if you have a limited network. What are some of the, you know, lessons learned or maybe advice or practical recommendations that you would have maybe even for yourself if you were starting out and just essentially be able to get that access to the right people, you know, at enterprise? What has worked well for you? What has not? Maybe share some thoughts there.
Totally. So you definitely want to start with your network. It's one of the most powerful tools at your disposal. So look through your network, get on the phone, have conversations, figure out who else you can speak with. But every conversation that you have, try to get through to whoever else can help you with this question. And when you hit upon a potential customer, don't immediately rush into, hey, let me go for the decision makers. You kind of want to have especially with the enterprise sector, you want to have a multi-layered approach where you are able to engage with the people who are affected, who will be the people who will be ultimately enjoying the solution. So you want to make sure you hear their voice as well before you engage decision makers, because they can have a different perspective on the problem altogether, and they might not be fully aware of the broader pains that their organization might be going through. So you have to address the problem multidimensionally, work to expand and increase your network. And then this is something that we had done, I think, a very good job in the last venture. It's building your network of referring partners. So figure out what are adjacent industries where perhaps your software, your solution can help them make a better sale, make a faster sale, where they're complementary to what that strategic partner might be selling, and see if you can form a partnership.
That makes a lot of sense. And there's just so many different semantics when it comes to just navigating the waters of the enterprise level. So appreciate sharing some of those insights. When it comes to, as a former executive myself and now an investor, I spend a lot of time thinking about the most important task for any CEO or anyone who is in charge of the company is hiring and selecting, finding the best talent. And I'll debate that any day with anybody who is, even remotely, operating any type of a company. So when it comes to three dimensions, let's say, for example, the most experienced or the most educated or the person who wants it the most, I will always choose the latter if I had to choose, mainly because there's just no substitute for hard work. The reason I mentioned that, I am curious about your personal strategies that help you find and retain the top talent. What do you look for in people that you surround yourself with? And what are the different traits and characteristics that that are very important to you?
Oh, good question. So basically, top three things we're looking for is for somebody to be smart, to be coachable, and to be driven. Without at least having these three qualities, you're not going to be able to find someone who, gets up in the morning and thinks, hey, how can we solve it? How can I grow? How can I, be a little better today than I was yesterday? Somebody who is receptive to new ways of doing things. And we find it particularly relevant today as we continue to innovate through the last 20 years. AI is a huge, huge, huge sidekick to everything that new businesses do. So figuring out how to incorporate that, how to make that helpful, how to extend your capabilities. And earlier on when it came out, there was a lot of resistance from the business world to adopt that. And that's a good determinant to see, hey, somebody kind of ready to reinvent themselves every day based on the feedback, based on the ecosystem around them, or they're not. And maybe that's entrepreneurship is probably not the right venue for them, or maybe not at this time in their lives, because we change too. And smart, of course, obviously.
How do you test for coachability aspect of traits? Because it's when I think about that, self-awareness is one of the first things that really comes to mind. But maybe think of questions that you like to ask during the interview process, or what are the, maybe when you hear responses, what do you look for that really helps you gauge that, you know, that person is very self-aware, they understand their weaknesses, they understand their strengths, but they're also in a capacity to take that type of feedback and take that into consideration and actually implement it.
All right, I'm going to reveal all the secrets now. Well, when you're going through the process of the interview, you kind of want to maybe prepare a couple of maybe trick questions, maybe where the answer may not be so straightforward, that would require some thinking and potentially some ambiguity. And then you can ask, hey, you know, you've answered this way, would you contemplate that you could have answered it the other way? So playing a little bit of a devil's advocate and seeing how they will respond to the changing conditions, environment around them. Sometimes you can ask them to do things a little differently. Like sometimes you can have actors filming a scene and you can say, hey, can you smile? Well, obviously that's not a suitable example, but you can say when you're interviewing somebody in pre-sales, hey, can you find a little bit different way to describe that? And see if they will do that based on the feedback. And you can give them time, depending on their role, to really think through their response. And so ultimately, you just look for that plasticity, the ability to adapt either right away or after some thought to the feedback.
Mm-hmm. That's a great example. And just overall, you know, interviewing process is very complex. A lot of people, they think they're very good at it. But at the end of the day, it's also boils down to kind of just creating that two-way street of a more of a conversation, as well to also provide the candidate an opportunity to make their own determination. If you're the right type of leader to, you know, to thrive under, is this the type of environment that really will help me succeed with my personal goals that I have? So that's, you know, we could probably spend the rest of the podcast talking about this. But moving things a little bit further, when it comes to, you know, obviously you're a serial entrepreneur and you've had your great deal share of working with investors. And just to take you a little bit back, the reason I really strive to, you know, to build my own fund, to build my own venture capital firm is because of the experiences that I had when I was fundraising for my own ventures. And I always thought that if I was ever on the other side of the spectrum, this is some of the things that I would do. This is some of the things that I would not do. Maybe share your perspectives and thoughts on your experiences with investors, whether that's, you know, professional VCs or angel investors and so forth. And more importantly, what do you look for in that type of relationship? What's really important for you? Or maybe what are the things that you try to stay away from?
So, good question. And I'm curious how, as a former operator, how you think about it. We see, and it's really good for new entrepreneurs who are getting into institutional investing or even angel investing to be aware of that you have a vision, you have a passion, you're looking for somebody to provide capital, but also it's an extension of your relationship. They will become your partners. Your investors will become your partners. So what kind of relationship is it going to be? Is it going to be a kind of a parent-child relationship, or is it going to be a truly partner? Ultimately, our investors in the private ventures we've been, again, very, very lucky in that they've been true partners to us. They got behind our vision, they got behind our decisions, and they were there when we needed to brainstorm ideas, when we wanted to, hey, can you elaborate, help us elaborate on the pricing strategy? Can you help us elaborate on the product rollout? Who can you introduce us to? So they were absolutely amazing. They were not prescriptive, and that was a huge kind of differentiator from kind of some of the other experiences I heard from other entrepreneurs. Ultimately, for somebody who is not in the driver's seat, they have a lot of experiences, they have a lot of connections, but being being out there on the field is very different than sitting in the sidelines. You only see so much of the game. So it is very difficult for investors to kind of stay in the sidelines if they're not in the field. And so it takes a lot of discipline for investors who potentially were formerly operators to not inject themselves too much. But those who are able to exercise that discipline ultimately develop really productive and healthy relationship with entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurs should be asking about that.
Something you said that's very, very important and resonates on so many levels, at least for me personally, that it's you don't want that parent-child relationship. You want that, you know, at the friend level. And at the end of the day, you know, if we're able to start a conversation, let's say, for example, with bad news, that's a great indicator that, you know, we have something there. And the opportunity also to collaborate on much smaller initiatives, projects, and maybe if I'm making an introduction, just seeing how you run with that, those are some of the activities that, you know, really help gauge the chemistry as well. Because as you've mentioned, it's a marathon and it's a long-term relationship. And if we're not enjoying working together, then it's going to be very, very challenging and difficult to collaborate. So that resonates. That resonates on many, many levels. But on the other side of the spectrum, when you are a new founder, you don't have much of a network, and you probably, you know, it's your first time as far as dealing with investors. It could be very intimidating, and at the same time, the importance of pre-qualifying and making sure that that investor profile or that type of investor is the right fit is of utmost importance. But it's very challenging to do that, because if you're in a crunch and you really need to fundraise, sometimes kind of maybe a desperation could kick in. What advice would you provide to entrepreneurs and founders who are maybe going through that? Because the reason I ask that is I encounter that on a daily basis, especially these days, where the capital is scarcity, the markets are completely different, and just fundraising in general is very challenging all across, for founders, even for funds, for anybody. What would be some of the, you know, just words of wisdom or things that maybe helped you in your early days to stay the course?
Well, there's kind of a lot to unpack in this question. So yeah. First of all, making sure that you always do your homework before committing to an institutional investor or any investor. You find out, you ask for a couple of references. What are they like to work with? You know, if you're in a dire straits and get engaged with someone who it's a really bad marriage to begin with, eventually you're risking the, you know, ultimately success overall. So it's probably you might want to do anything you can other than to engage into something that you don't think it's going to be a good direction to go into, somebody who you don't get along with, who don't have a healthy relationship with. And make sure you don't skip the homework part, understanding what they're like to work with. For somebody who is a new entrepreneur and you kind of engaged and you made a decision to work with an institutional investor, what was absolutely delightful about the first time when we brought in an institutional investor, I had asked our contact to if he would be willing to spend an hour a week with me for a number of weeks. And I absolutely enjoyed getting up to speed on anything we were missing, not having an institutional investor before, metrics, operations, anything that we were able to absorb from somebody who had worked with tens of dozens of other startups to get us up to speed much faster. That was absolutely amazing. And I commend their patience sticking with me throughout this discovery process. And then, making themselves available when I said, okay, I got everything I wanted to get for this moment. I'm going to obviously continue executing, but they made themselves available, and that was huge. As far as navigating through the difficult times, it's about you know, keeping an eye on your books, making sure you do everything you can not to allow yourself to get past the point where it will become really, really difficult. Keeping an eye on finances, keeping an eye on your roadmap, on your cash burn, and continuously working on expanding your network of potential investors, because you never know how things are. You don't want to show up when things are bad. You want to cultivate that relationship so that they're in the loop. They know, you know, you're executing on a solid vision. You didn't just show up at their door. They've known you for some time. So continue cultivating those relationships when you don't need the cash, so that you can potentially lean in on them when you need it, when you need to.
That's some very powerful advice, and that was, you know, that nugget alone is probably worth the entire podcast altogether. So appreciate those insights. Taking us back to, you know, Setuply and everything you guys are currently building, what are the different challenges that you guys are dealing with at this stage of the company and the growth? Where are you at, and how do you guys go about solving some of those problems?
I mean, we're very, very early in our process. We are wrapping up our beta implementations and moving forward with officially launching the product live. So I would say this is a honeymoon period of a startup, where you are sort of taking your time to work with the early customers to understand their needs from every possible perspective, to then prepare to scale that across a much broader customer base. It's a lot of planning work. It's planning out how your sales operations are going to work, how your sales are going to grow, how your implementation and customer support. So it's a very fun period. And I would recommend, for, and having gone through this several times, I think a lot of kind of companies look at that as an afterthought, like, oh, we've grown up to do this, let's do this. If at all possible, start to think about how you're going to support them the minute you start building the product. How are you going to promote your product? How are you going to go to market as before you start building the product? Because retrofitting that, or being responsive, or when the customers are standing at your door knocking, that it will help avoid a lot of headache if you put some kind of thought process in place before you have to deal with the avalanche of new business if you hit upon something that resonates hugely with the market.
In the current juncture where you at and where you know now, I'm sure that pivots changes, you know, probably by the minute. In terms of the, and I'll reformulate the question, because one of the traits that I see in very successful founders is the ability to go from that idea to the product and then to the execution. And for you to also get an understanding of who is the ultimate customer for your particular product, maybe tell us a little bit more about that, what type of a company that is, and how did you figure that out? What are some of the things that you guys executed as an organization to be able to make that determination that this is the profile of the customer who would ultimately will benefit the most from our solution?
Got it. And it's every single time it's a very revelatory process where you think you're doing one thing, and in the end you kind of realize, hey, it's actually impacting a broader or different group of people. So initially we set out to build a product that makes lives easier for onboarding reps, to basically give them something meaningful, make projects a little bit more scalable. And as we continue to get into it, we realize that, hey, customer experience actually with spreadsheets is pretty miserable. When you're trying to implement and somebody gives you a 15-tab spreadsheet and says, knock yourself out, enjoy. And yeah, by the way, there's no security, you know, just put something there. So we realized that poor onboarding experience also affects customers in a big way, and it drives potentially churn, dissatisfaction, disengagement. Sales just offered something really amazing, and then you show up to a spreadsheet, because you're going to see that spreadsheet until you finish the onboarding process. So we realized that impact. And as we continue to dig in, we realized that without proper onboarding, especially in the world of SaaS, many of the solution providers cannot monetize the sale. So you sold, your sales reps are happy and on vacation, Meanwhile, until the client is onboarded and they have to be engaged throughout, the company's books do not see any difference. There's nothing in the bank, and especially for organizations that are PE, VC, institutional funded, sale only looks great on paper until there's actually implementation, happy customer. You can't really hope for recurring revenue streams. And so then we realized that actually the organization, the solution provider as a whole is affected by onboarding. It's not just the reps, it's not just the clients, it's company's profitability. And in some cases we've encountered by delaying that implementation by an extra month, that could mean profitability in year one or year two. It's huge. And especially given the kind of market conditions that we see today, where the impetus is not just on the growth, it's on the sustainable growth and on the profitability metric, it becomes a much broader problem and a much broader solution to address onboarding and make sure they're locked in and they're part of, truly they're part of your customer base rather than just sitting there on the books.
Taking us back to the beginning of our conversation, when we spoke about exits, when we spoke about acquisitions, thinking about the most recent company that you had exited, and that's an ongoing also conversation with a lot of other founders in terms of how do those relationships actually get initiated, or how do those conversations actually even get started? And a lot of that also boils down to just, there's no single ingredient that goes into that. It's also very relationship based. But from your experience, maybe share some insights that allowed you to also understand that maybe this is a perfect fit for a potential acquisition of your company, because at the end of the day, it's your baby. It's something that you've built from the ground up. And it's also a very, very emotional exercise too. What were some of the strategies that really helped you succeed through that space? Maybe tell us a little bit more about those conversations and how did that all get started that really led to a particular company acquiring your company?
So they're all very, very different. As you said, there is no specific recipe to initiate an exit. I think it goes back to the conversation we had about finding an investment partner. As you start to build, think about what problem you're solving, who is impacted by the problem, and who could be potentially interested in, I mean, as much as you kind of want to keep solving the problem forever, there could be bigger synergies in place than you might anticipate when you start solving it. And so at least having some awareness what those potential synergies, complementary industries or markets or whatnot that could have interest in having a solution, having some thought probably is a good way to start. But ultimately, it's about broadening your network. It's about having many conversations. It's about keeping your company in a healthy operating order, and just being open to conversations about who needs problem. I mean, obviously, you don't go out there and you don't build with the thought, who am I going to sell it to? But continuing to grow your network, and that's kind of a job of the senior executive leadership. Having the vision for what could be the future for my organization, is this something that could go in the public market? Who could be a strategic partner? The big component, and you mentioned some of it a little earlier, of what makes building so exciting and what gets us back. One of the legacies is A, solving the problem, but B, creating jobs, creating future for the people that work for us, that make us a part of our journey. That is the long-lasting legacy. And that's what makes it kind of very poignant and cool, I think. So thinking, what is their life is going to be like in 10, 15 years? What are you doing? They've trusted you with their career. What are you doing to make them really on top of their game 5 years from now, 10 years from now? How are you helping them? So that in itself kind of helps to drive everything forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the same time, it's also a huge responsibility as well. And, you know, as they say, excellence is the capacity to take pain. So if you're able to take on that responsibility and you're capable of understanding the importance of that, and combine that with the passion and drive that you have for building and solving a particular problem, that's a recipe for success. Last portion of every podcast that I love to focus is just on you as an individual. So maybe first share, outside of building multiple companies and spending, 24/7 on those, how important is the balance, and maybe something that really helps you succeed in that space, because a lot of times it's easier said than done, especially in the early days when you're just starting out and the company is just getting off the ground and it feels like it's a 365, 24/7 type of engagement. Maybe share some conversations you have with your employees, with your peers, with everyone in your company when it comes to managing that balance.
Here I'd like to give a shout out to Professor Stu Friedman. He taught total leadership at Wharton University, and it was about balancing out different domains in your life. Yourself, you have to invest into self, because you have to have a strong enough foundation to support people that are around you who trusted you to be a part of your mission. So self, it's your work, it's your community, and making sure you're balancing your time between these important domains, your family, of course, to make sure that you're supporting their tremendous source of support to you. And you should be out there, not just focusing on work, because that's, when you're building a building, you kind of needs a few things there to support. So you need those other domains to really make that marathon sustainable, fulfilling your family, your community, your work, and yourself, and make sure you find the time for all of them. And what I do for fun is travel the world and eat interesting foods. And this summer, it's been number 67, South Korea. Oh, nice. Highly recommended.
That's super exciting and very powerful advice. In terms of, last but not least, the sources of information, the sources of learning for you, what do you consume? Maybe share some of the books that you read, or maybe if there's a book that you always like to recommend to others, what is that and why is that?
Pitch Anything is one of my favorites. It's about understanding how other people process information so you can communicate better. Never Split the Difference. I read that after the exit at the last company. Probably would have made navigating a little bit easier if you read it before, so highly recommend it. Every year I reread Stu's Total Leadership book. Ultimately, part of it, sometimes, especially when running a startup, work gets in the way of life, and you have to remind yourself that there's other things in life that you need to engage in, like reading books and traveling and taking a little bit of time off so you could come back refreshed with new ideas to pursue your favorite hobby.
Rachel, I can't thank you enough for today's conversation. It was very short and insightful. I personally learned quite a bit, and you were very generous with some of the advice and insights that you had shared with us and our audience. What I love doing with all the podcast guests is do a follow-up recording in about a year where we revisit the conversation and see if everything we've discussed still makes sense, still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Sounds like a plan. Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.